Hello. Before you start this episode of The Game Changers, I wanted to take a moment to tell you about our new documentary, Abby Ward, A Bump in the Road, which explores the challenges faced by professional female athletes and all working mothers. It follows the remarkable journey of an England rugby player as she battles back to the professional game just 17 weeks after the birth of her baby, and then on to secure her place in England's Six Nations squad for 2024. The documentary is free to watch in the UK on ITVX or globally on Rugby Pass TV. And don't forget that our other documentary, Game On, The Unstoppable Rise of Women's Sport, is still available to watch on Netflix in the UK. Now it's time for the Game Changers. Hello and welcome to The Game Changers, the podcast where you'll hear from trailblazing women in sport who are knocking down the barriers and challenging the status quo for women and girls everywhere. I'm your host, Sue Anstis, and I'd like to start with a huge thank you to Barclays for once again supporting this series of The Game Changers, which features fearless women in football and reinforces their incredible support for the beautiful game. Today is my great privilege to talk to someone who's having a huge impact beyond the field of play. It's Anita Asante. A hugely prominent figure in the footballing world, Anita's a former Lioness who currently plays for Aston Villa in the FAWSL. Anita has 71 caps for England in a career that spanned 14 years. She's played in two World Cups, three European Championships, and she represented Team GB in the London 2012 Olympics. Along with her career as a professional footballer, Anita now spends time talking about women's sport in her roles for the BBC and Sky Sport. She's also a passionate ambassador for equality, working with charities including Show Racism the Red Card and Amnesty International UK. Anita was part of an incredible Arsenal team that won the quadruple, and I wonder what she thought it was that had made them so successful.
I just think it was a great generation of players and, you know, lots of personalities, good big characters and leaders. You know, I learned a lot from the likes of Jane Ludlow and even Sian Williams in my early stages of my career, and Claire Wheatley, Rachel Yankee, just to name a few. But, you know, there was a generation of us younger players too that came through together, like myself and Alex Scott, Leanne Sanderson. So I think there was just a great spirit and buzz around the team and a good energy at the club at the time as well. I think the men were so successful as well. So there was a good kind of, we always used to describe it as a family feel within the club as well. And everyone felt part of this like bigger experience, if you like. The driving force was the sort of energy and the personalities and characters.
And it is amazing, as you say, those names there, where they've all gone off to do other things and what they've gone on to do in their careers too. It's quite extraordinary, really, isn't it? And how did you change as a player during your time there, do you think?
I think I grew in confidence as time went on and as I got opportunities within the different age groups and coming through the youth ranks into the senior team, into something that I knew was big. You know, I knew this was a top side. There was a legacy already within an established, senior women's side. So you almost had that sense of, you know, I have big boots to fill coming in and I want to show that I'm good enough as well. So I think that's how, for me, it was a great motivating push to develop and break into the team.
And how had football been a part of your life before then?
Yeah, I mean, I always played in my local areas with local kids on my estate and in school. So I was always playing sort of street football, if you like. And that was my passion. And that was the first thing I wanted to do when I got back from school, you know, dump all my uniform before my mum and dad could scream at me to do homework. And that's kind of where it began for me. And then it kind of progressed into getting to the Arsenal Centre of Excellence and so on and so forth.
And how did your family feel about you playing football when you were young? Were there any typical gender stereotypes to overcome at all?
Largely, my parents are really supportive. luckily, and my dad was already a big Arsenal fan, so I think that made it easier for them to get behind me and support me. My mum wasn't a massive football fan at the time, and I think when we talk about it now, she would say it was a great experience for her too, because she learned so much about the game and people involved, and she enjoyed that sense of socializing and community that comes with, you know, traveling with me to football and training and all of that sort of thing. But no, you know, I used to get from my grandparents who still live in Ghana more like, you know, why are you letting her play football? She should be, you know, doing other things and preparing for family and the future and that type of thing. But as I've progressed and with my success, I think they've all really, you know, supported me and respected what I've done, and they're really proud as well, which is great, because I've managed to shift, I think, mindsets as well there from a completely different, you know, generation.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm going to come on to that in a moment too. And why football? Why did you choose football? I imagine you must have been a great athlete in terms of other sports too, but what was it about football that you loved, do you think?
I played netball in school. I did athletics. I sort of would try my hand at everything in school in terms of PE and the school teams. But I think football was just the one sport that I felt I could express myself, and I could always learn something new, and I could always develop a new skill or a new challenge. And it brought that sort of inner self-esteem out and confidence. So I love that team element, you know, of making new friends. You know, I found so many different connections with people through playing football, whether that was in my local area or with my teams at Arsenal. It is the easiest thing to get involved in and engage with as a kid. I think all you need is one ball, and literally everybody gravitates to that, and you can create a game and a game situation. And that's what it really was for me.
And when do you think you realised that you were really, really good?
People used to tell me I was good in a way, you know, like boys I played with, parents, even in school, my head of PE was super supportive and pushy. And she used to tell me that she felt that I was somewhat subdued in what I could do, and that I was holding myself back a little bit, and I needed to come out and show that more. But I think I knew I was really good, I guess, when I got to Arsenal in the youth teams, and what we collectively was doing as a team in terms of performances and results, and then getting into England youth setup, I felt like, okay, you know, I guess I am a decent player. I'm not, you know, I'm all right at this, and I just want to see what more I can do.
And I often ask, I've been very lucky to talk to lots of Lionesses, but that kind of first cap and your memory of that first cap. But can you remember the build up to the first time of your playing for England? What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was probably this young teenager, you know, 18 years old, oversized kits from that generation, showing up to a camp and, you know, learning, I think, about the whole senior environment. And then getting up to that game against, I believe it was Iceland, and just, you know, being like, oh my God, like I'm going to play my very first game for England potentially. And then it happened. And it's kind of an overwhelming experience of emotion, you know, excitement, maybe a little bit of trepidation in terms of, you know, wanting to perform. So your anxiety levels, your nerves. I definitely had that. I've always been quite good, I think, at concealing some of that energy and wanting it to sort of manifest once I enter the pitch and get that first touch, that first pass. And yeah, you know, amazing experience to get there. For me, it was like, you know, to get there and be there and then have my chance. Incredible.
I guess I hadn't thought about that before, but I guess for many players, you're coming off the bench almost, like you don't know whether you're going to be subbed on, and for your first game you're not necessarily named on the first team.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you learning in those moments what it's like to make sure you're prepared, you know, mentally as well, to know whether you're a starting player coming into a game or potentially called upon during the state of a match. You're there and you're on, you know you've got to be on. There is a level of pressure, there is a level of expectation, but you know, recognizing that's why you're there, because you're good enough to be there and compete.
And you obviously then had, many other games for England. I mean, it was a real surprise, I think, for most people, when you were left out of the World Cup squad in 2015. Looking back now, why do you think that was?
Yeah, I think like every coach, they have an idea of the type of players they want to bring in and the type of playing style, perhaps, or what they need in terms of the synergy within a group. And I think I've always considered myself more of a ball playing defender or center midfielder, however which way you look at it, throughout my career. And those are the types of teams and clubs that I've played for, possession oriented type teams. So I think with that manager, he was looking for a more direct style of play, possibly, players that will run and beyond and find direct balls and really aggressive, really, in the pressure and things like that. And I perhaps didn't fit that mold, and that's okay. That's football. And I also wondered myself, would I have enjoyed it? Would I have been able to fulfill what he would want out of me? Because maybe that isn't my strength in my personal game. So yeah, as much as it was disappointing, I can't lie and say I wasn't disappointed. That's part of the game. And that's part of the journey of wanting to get back as well into different teams. And yeah, and that's how I took it.
Excellent. And talking, I guess, more about your club career. So you obviously played for Arsenal for a decade and then moved on to Chelsea. And then in 2009, you went to play in the US. So what made you take that decision, as it were, to head to the States at that time?
Yeah, at the time, I think I had an inner sense of I need a new challenge. I want something different. I want to know and experience what more is out there in terms of a club environment, coaching. And that's why I initially made the shift to Chelsea, because at Arsenal, we were the dominant team in the country. And I wanted to see if I could add to another team and improve that team and compete. But then when America came knocking, it was a full-time professional experience that I felt there's no way I can turn this down. I don't want to look back in a few years and be regretting that I didn't take the opportunity. And that's really why I ended up going to New Jersey. Yeah.
And what was the toughest part for moving overseas?
I mean, I think transition is always tough, regardless of where you're going. But leaving my family behind, leaving my friends, my kind of support network, I guess your comfort zone, so to speak, what you're used to, your routines, knowing that I was walking into the unknown because this was brand new, the league, everything. Me going there, me along with a lot of other players, it's our first experience of what does it mean to be a professional? What does it look like? What are the expectations? I had no idea really going into it. So there was a lot of that kind of feeling of, I hope that I will be okay, will feel safe, feel secure, if you like, in that environment.
And was it very different to the football you'd experienced in the UK at the time? Did it feel like a different level?
It did in a different way. I think in the UK, we've been used to, technical individual players, maybe players who sometimes show a little spark or something different and unique. And in the US, you're always guaranteed to have a massive pool of talent who are athletic, who are super fit, who are very highly motivated, winning, have that winning mentality. And that's what I walked into, that type of environment, big characters, lots of voices, people that were confident to take space and be present. I would say that was the biggest thing, but that winning mentality, that never say die attitude, was really what I witnessed firsthand.
I spoke to Jess Fishlock for the podcast, actually, and she said she feels in the US they take women's sport more seriously than in the UK. Is that what you found? Did you feel that when you were out there?
Yeah, I mean, I can relate to that. I can understand why Jess would say that, because I think looking back at my career in the early days when the game was largely amateur in the UK, a lot of us were just doing it because we were passionate about it and we love it. And that was that. And, maybe there isn't the same kind of pressure because there isn't this outward looking industry into the sport like there is now. But in the USA, with a successful women's national team, the 99ers and all of that, they already knew what it meant to get that kind of attention. you know, attention from the nation, attention from the media. And with that reward, you know, there's an outcome. So there's more to, I guess, aspire for. For the US players, it means everything. It means a lot to be professional, but it means a lot even in the college level. To get to college is like a huge deal. Yeah. Get on your team, and then who knows what could amount from that. So I definitely feel like, yeah, of course they took it seriously, but there's so much at stake, you know, and to represent their national team, which is highly successful, globally very well known. Yeah. That was, you know, probably the driving force for the attitude and environment of those players.
And you mentioned that transition. You obviously moved around a lot in your years across there. As the league changed and teams traded you and then folded and traded again. And other players have experienced that a lot too. So how challenging was it to readjust to new teams in such a short space of time?
Yeah, it was really difficult because on the back of that transition, I'd also had a long-term injury. I did my ACL in 2009. I had a successful season with Sky Blue in the championship. And then a new manager came in. The ownership decided they wanted to trade me to St. Louis, got to St. Louis. And although I was somewhat sad, you know, I had a mixture of emotions. I was sad. I was leaving behind lots of friends. My partner at the time was stuck in New Jersey. I was going to be in St. Louis. It was difficult. It was really difficult. And it was such a short space of time between being there and, you know, within days you're in the new club and a new team. But once I got there, I was kind of like, it was hard for the first few days or so. You know, I was on the phone to my mum and dad and my friends, and everyone was very positive and trying to encourage me to just, you know, go with the flow, take it as it comes, and just give my best, really. And then, yeah, the club folded within 20 days of being there. Yeah. So it was a bit of a whirlwind. It felt like it happened really quickly. I'd only played one game for the club, so for that to happen, everyone was in shock, in all honesty. Yeah. No one really knew what the next step would be. And then obviously, long story, there was the league, you know, they came in with their rules and I was able to move on. So I went to Chicago, fantastic city. I was excited to experience, you know, what Chicago had to offer. A great squad at the time, you know, had Megan Rapinoe there, Cristiani, Ella Massa, a number of players, Casey Nogueira. And then I wasn't getting the playing opportunity as much as I would have liked at the time. And the club was going through transition again with management. I, in that instance, asked for the trade.
Right.
And I finished the season in Washington. And, you know, that was a transition because I lived with two or three different host families, I believe, at the time. So, you know, I was sort of house jumping. But I really felt happy at the end of that season to have landed there in an environment and a playing style that I liked as well.
And what were some of the highlights from playing in the US when you look back now on those years?
Well, I think winning the championship with Sky Blue has to be up there.
Yeah.
In the first season with that team, especially, we literally rode a lot of highs and lows together. We had a lot of different transitions and problems within that season. And managerial changes, and the way we came together is unreal. But it wouldn't have happened without the leadership. We had players like Heather O'Reilly, Christy Rampone, you know, real people that I looked up to, people I knew had done it at the big stage, and just such positive attitude. And, you know, as my now coach would say, mental monsters. You know, they have that monster mentality to just ride the challenges and get through it and believe in themselves. But yeah, I think for me, the bonds that I've had created with players that have lasted beyond those years, you know, I'm still very good friends with a lot of those girls, like Ella Massa, we still talk, we're still close, and Yael Ava Bush, and just the whole experience of playing up against the best. You know, had Abby Wambach as my captain at Washington.
I'm trying to get her on the podcast, so I might have to talk to you about that afterwards.
We try and work that out. Yeah, for sure. But I just think they were incredible people as well as players, and they brought that passion. And I think they brought that I will compete every day attitude to training. And that's what made me and a lot of other players, I think, better as well, to try to bring that into our own kind of personas as well. And hopefully I've taken some lessons from that, you know, along my career.
And you then moved on to play in Sweden. So can you just talk us through that decision?
Yeah. Obviously, the league folded in, I think it was 2011. And I lived with a Swedish player when I played at Sky Blue in my final season, Therese Höglund. And she always used to say to me, Neets, like, you have to come to Sweden. I think you would love it. You know, your personality, you're chill like Swedes. you'd get on like really well. And I was kind of in this, you know, mindset of, I don't know if I'm going to go to Germany or to Sweden. But my gut feeling just told me, you know, really go for it. And Sweden would be a good fit. That's how it ended up. Like, I spoke to my agent. He got in touch with Gothenburg. Yeah. And then I just, you know, I didn't know much about the team or the club. I knew a little bit about the league, especially from my time back when I played at Arsenal, meeting Swedish clubs in Champions League. You know, I knew the standard was pretty good. It honestly was probably the best decision I ever made during that time in my career. That's the one decision I'm certain of was right for me. And, you know, I thoroughly enjoyed my experience there.
What was different, I guess, in terms of life as a professional athlete in Sweden? You went on to play for 4 years at Malmo, didn't you, for Rosengard?
Yes, that's right. I mean, the difference is the element of, you know, in America, I think the marketing behind the franchises, you know, the branding of the players, the raising of profiles is a big part of the internal football landscape in what they're trying to drive in terms of fan base and sponsorship and obviously money and sustainability. Whereas in Sweden, I think that's a lot more subdued. The football economy is a lot smaller, especially just because the men's game isn't, you know, as big as some of the other bigger markets. So that element of support isn't necessarily there, but I think they do a great job of finding lots of independent ownerships and sponsors to run women's clubs. And some of them are women's only clubs, if that makes sense, that have just developed in organically to be servicing girls and women's football. Excellent. For generations historically. And that's what I got to realize, you know, the clubs felt like more than just clubs in some respect, especially in my time at Rosengård. It felt more than just a football club. They really wanted to be able to be part of the community and support a lot of the kind of social projects within Malmo. And then they have a project in South Africa, for example, that, you know, they have players go out to that supports young girls in education and utilizing football as a way of bringing out their self-esteem and confidence. And I was like, wow, this is interesting. This makes me feel like I know that as footballers, you can give a lot as, you know, role models and giving a platform for young players to aspire to. But it also allowed me to find kind of my, I guess, social political activism in a way. And I loved that about that, because it brought out different parts of all of us as people, you know, aside from being footballers.
Excellent. Oh, it's really good to hear, isn't it? Really good. And you came back to play at Chelsea before your recent move to Aston Villa. So I was looking back, you've been at two of the most successful ever women's clubs in terms of Arsenal and now Chelsea. Are there any similarities, do you think, as you look at the two of them and the way they're managed or the way the teams gel together?
Yeah, I mean, I think in any championship team that there is something uniquely special about a group when they win a league or a cup or whatever. And of course, that is the environment, and the environment is steered by the players and the management. And in this case, Emma, you know, she's been in those environments before. She's led those environments. So I think she has a great understanding of what it takes and the kinds of not only footballers, but personalities you need to build that competitiveness and that winning belief and that idea of, you know, how do we make each other look good? How do we make each other better? And I think that's what Chelsea has built over the last few seasons. Very highly motivated players, all with a broad experience of playing at different clubs and, you know, good clubs as well, and have achieved a lot already for some of them for being so young. But yeah, I think she's always talked about having good people in the group, people that are willing to support each other but demand more from each other. That's important, that we are professionals and, you know, we are there to do a job and we all have a goal, but that goal is something that we all wanted as players, yeah, and as a group. And the only way we're going to get there is if we push each other and we support each other to get there. And Emma has a great understanding of that.
You're clearly, as you've mentioned, an athlete who's embraced your platform to use your voice for social good. So do you think there was a particular moment when you realised that you could impact society in that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think being part myself of the LGBTQ plus community, I think we're always on that side of having to talk about the issues that affect our communities, which impacts me personally and it impacts people around me, people I care about. Having the platform that I have, I think it's important that I show up. And that's how I look at it. Like, you know, showing up for those people and myself and making sure that, you know, policies and things that affect our society don't get rolled back when people have worked so hard to get us to this point. And it's no different to women's football, you know? It started with pioneers who have led us to this point, and they've pushed really hard by being there, being visible, by doing it against all odds. And now it's for the next generations onwards to carry that torch so that it can't be rolled back and those opportunities will continue to exist for the next generation. And yeah, so I guess that's part of it. It's part of me, you know? Who I am is political for some reason. Being a black female, being an athlete, being a woman, all of these are political, whether people don't like it or not, because that's what is presented to us. You know, when we talk about equality and equal pay or these things, they're all political things that affect our lives. And, you know, when I played in Sweden, all the work they did around social mobility with refugees and things like that made me realize, you know, I'm in a great position to sort of help someone else who's come through a really difficult transition in their life. And how can we utilize football to support that and bring back their passion and their joy? And I think from that point onwards, I wanted to get involved with Amnesty. So I got involved at Amnesty's football welcomes. And from then on, it's just progressed. And I just feel like it's important, really. It's just important to utilize this platform and use my voice.
Excellent. And as you say, you're very open about being a gay woman. As you grew up during your football career as a younger player, do you feel that coming out was almost discouraged from within the game for a while?
Yeah, it's like everything. There are subliminal messages, aren't there, around us all the time. None of us can go, yeah, the game itself explicitly said, don't come out, don't be yourself, don't do these things. But the subliminal messages in the culture and the behaviours around us suggest that it's not safe to do so, or it's not the right thing to do. Yeah. So even as a young player myself, and a lot of players I've played with, you know, you would have internalised your feelings or your emotions and not done that because it didn't feel safe. Amongst us, we felt so safe to be ourselves because we created that space. We created the space where we could be open and honest, and you always had someone close to you, perhaps a teammate or coach that you could rely on and you knew would listen. But in the bigger picture, I think it was just different times as well, where you didn't have, like today, the visible, I guess, as visible role models that are openly out there utilizing, you know, the media to showcase their stories.
Yeah, and just normalize it.
And normalize it and also open up the conversation and the discussion. Because I understand not everybody feels like they have the tools or the language to delve into some of these subject matters. But I think when we get it out there and we say, you know, we need to talk about, we need to think about the people and the young people as well who are struggling to come out, who don't have the confidence. Well, sport is a great vehicle for bringing that out of people and giving them the opportunity to be themselves and express themselves. And they'll be able to express themselves fully when they can be completely their authentic self.
And do you think it's easier today for young women playing today to come out and be more authentic, live their authentic lives sooner than perhaps you did? Because you were fairly late in coming out in terms of the public and the kind of football world.
Yeah, I came out when I was around 23. And, you know, I struggled with it a long time just because of my own preconceptions of how people would respond to me, my family, my friends, people I work with. And of course, that's part of my own internal struggle, not just what is around you. Yeah. But I do hope that today's generation would feel more confident to come out, because there are so many more tools available, I guess, and organizations out there willing to support people, professionals who can help in this area if you don't have that in support network that's close to you. But I think, you know, especially in the women's game, that we're trying to encourage awareness by supporting, you know, campaigns like Rainbow Laces. Of course, there's a lot more to be done in every aspect across these intersections. But I think by being visible, exposing it, you know, having managers, players, people working within the game that are from the LGBTQ plus community, referees, it just shows, you know, that the game wants to become more inclusive. And yeah, it, and it's continuing to show that. And the more we can do that, the more hopefully people outside the game will go, you know what, I can be that. I can be who I want to be and have a job, you know, that I enjoy, have people around me that will support me and thrive, basically.
It is so important, isn't it? I love the photos, actually, that you and Beth share on Instagram. I particularly love the Christmas pyjama photograph. But I love that whole, it's just completely natural. This is as it is. And that's almost that in itself. The social media side has so much negativity, doesn't it? But actually, there are some really positive sides to that too, that it just portrays your lives.
Yeah, I think it's about humanising all of us, isn't it? And just making us, like, we're the average person that enjoys coffee and cake or whatever and silly, you know, matching pajamas or whatever it is, but that our relationships are real and they're normal. And it's just about, you know, love. And we want people to engage with us that have the same attitude to life and to others and to consider other people's feelings. And that's where I feel then social media does good, because it shows that and it allows not only us, but lots of people to connect who can relate and who want to be allies or whatever and share content in a positive way. So if we just make a difference to one person, then it's a great thing.
Yeah, I'm sure. Lots more than one, I'm sure. Yes. You're also an ambassador for Show Racism, the Red Card. Can you tell me a little bit more about the charity and the work you're doing there, your involvement?
Yeah, well, the charity is throughout the UK and it does a lot of work in the education sector. So they have educators in racism and discrimination that go around to different clubs and engage with schools and young people. And also, you know, ex-players. Shaka Hislop is one of the main ambassadors of the charity, or started the charity, if you like. And the ambition is really to get young people to discuss things around race and showcase it through poetry, spoken words, lots of creative ways, right, basically. And they have a competition every year where the schools can compete and show their best work, if you like, and then they'll get a special gift from the charity. Yeah, it's just a great way, I think, to try to have these, I think what a lot of people might deem as difficult conversations, to make them not so difficult. And I think, you know, the earlier we get to children who are the most innocent, open citizens, if you like, they are willing to just take in and absorb information. And they are so logical and so rational. They can take in a lot of these, what we might, you know, like I said, deem as very difficult subject matters, and they just make it seem like nothing. And, you know, and they're creative and expressing their friendships, their joys at learning other cultures and experiences. And again, I just think it's about normalizing it and normalizing the interaction among young people, because they are the future. They'll be our future leaders. They'll be the people steering society. And we want it to keep growing and developing into a very unified and inclusive one.
And obviously you've played across different countries. You know, we've talked and playing in the US and the UK and Sweden. So how has your race and sexuality been received in different ways by in different societies, do you feel? Have you been perceived differently?
Yeah, I think when I played in the US, I didn't really experience anything that was, you know, negative as such or anything like that. I felt I was really embraced by my teammates, my club, the franchise. Everyone treated me the same. Yeah. I think to some degree we're largely in a bubble as well in our own world, because you don't really, I don't know, live outside of your social networks. So yeah. You don't get exposed to everything either. But it was largely a positive experience for me. You know, I loved it. I loved the coming of different cultures together. You know, I had a Brazilian coach, I had Brazilian teammates, players from different parts of the world, Australia, Germany, wherever. And that's what it's about, you know, learning about each other and what makes each other tick and what things that interest us. And same in Sweden, always had really positive experience with players and the management. I felt at home. I really did feel at home there for the 6 years I was there. I really enjoyed Scandinavian culture. I think the only time I ever experienced something that was a little bit like off was when, and that was in like normal life, like, you know, outside of my football environment, just at a cafe and with my teammates, and an older gentleman walked past me and put his hands in my hair, like a complete stranger. Like I didn't know him. Just, and I had my back to the street because it was outdoor seating, and it just took me by surprise, and my teammates looked at me like horrified, like, what just happened there? And I was like, honestly, I don't know. But yeah, that was the only time that I was just like, oh, you know, that's not really okay. Like, that's when, because, you know, it felt like an invasion of my personal space. Yeah. But no, otherwise, you know, I had such great experiences.
And do you think things have improved in terms of how football bodies are dealing with racism now?
No, I don't think it's improved. I think, you know, I wasn't born in the 70s. I was born in the 80s, but I know all the stories about that period of time. You know, I was a youngster in the 80s, you know, when I was born. So I wasn't privy to all the experiences that a lot of the adults talk about today, of what it was like, but I'm aware, and you know, it's well archived and documented. So if I think back to that time and I think to what's happening now, when there are no fans and there's still on field incidences, obviously we know social media has a role to play in abuse in general and in racism, but I can't really say that it has progressed, in all honesty. Only recently a player gets, I think, a ban, 10-match ban or whatever it is, or less than that. And players are getting more significant penalties for betting and gambling and all of
wearing
that.
Wearing the wrong logo or whatever.
Yeah, wearing the wrong brand. So for me, it's like, where are your priorities, really? Like, where are you really saying that we have zero tolerance and we really want to stamp it out of the game? In terms of actions, it doesn't really look like that, in my opinion. And I have been critical already in the past about the three-step protocol, because I think if I was in public or you was in public and someone was verbally abusive or physically abusive, would I give them three shots to maybe get it right? I don't think so. So, you know, for me, it's the onus is still on the victim, and it's always on the victims. Will the player walk off? Should the team walk off? Well, sorry, they're, you know, for me, they're the governing bodies with the power and the policies. So govern it. Take that responsibility off of the teams. The teams shouldn't be getting penalties if they do decide to make that decision and walk off as a result of that. So no, to answer your question, I don't think it's improved. I don't think it's gone as far as it can to really make a signal that they want to make a difference.
Yeah. And within the women's game, it's obviously great that we see the likes of Eneluco and Hope Powell taking leadership roles within football. But in terms of backroom staff, so coaches, etc., do you feel the women's game is any better than the men's in terms of diversity?
Well, I feel very fortunate now to be at Villa, where I feel like the club as a whole is definitely looks visibly more diverse than a lot of clubs I've been at before. Yeah. And I know that they are really wanting to drive that through their foundations and different projects within the club, which is a great signal for where the game, at least at Villa, wants to go. But my experience tells me that, you know, football hasn't been as inclusive as it should be. We need to identify why that is and how we can really drive that message that we want people from all different backgrounds in the game, because there's lots of roles and opportunities in football, like you say, in backroom staff, physios, you know, massage therapists, psychologists, you name it. There's a lot, sports scientists, officials, and we're still not seeing as many. So yeah, I do think there are maybe certain preconceptions, barriers that are preventing people from really stepping up for those roles. Because, you know, one example we can use is, you know, they say women in general don't apply for managerial jobs or promotions because they feel they don't fulfill every single criteria listed on a, so that wouldn't be so hard to imagine for certain disadvantaged groups or diverse groups yeah. that feel that, you know, people don't see me in this role because it hasn't existed, or they don't feel I am qualified enough or whatever. So they hold themselves back. But the point yeah. is, we need to get them in the door and also support that development.
And we've talked a little about the huge impact of female activists. And obviously in the last year, we've seen the likes of the WNBA players and the NWSL players, the likes of Naomi Osaka, etc. Do you think that in a way, women's sports, so female athletes, can almost have more social impact than men's?
Well, I feel like women's sports does have a massive social impact. Yeah. And women are always having this impact because women are always having to voice up and step up for the things that we're still striving for. So we naturally take on that responsibility for the most part. I actually feel like it's about connecting the two. I feel like men and women sport need to come together, and we need to have that kind of allyship that's going to boost it even further, because that's the other half of the population or society that can make the difference. Actually, I think because of the popularity of men's sports and the long historical presence it's had, I also think it's time for them to also step up and actually put their front foot forward and be that voice to support it. You know, I think it should be collaborative. You'd seen that with Andy Murray, you know. Yeah. You know, how impressive has he been in his press conferences to really speak his mind and say what he means and support women's tennis. It would be great if we could get that across lots of different industries.
Indeed. We are in agreement there, actually. It often surprises me that we don't hear men, especially those elite athletes, almost stepping forward to support the female. So Andy Murray stands out as like an example of one. Yeah. But you would like to think there are hundreds of us that could do the same, aren't there? And what advice would you give to young female players starting out in their careers now, perhaps, in terms of how they can use their platforms for good?
Well, I just say to young players, like, be yourself. Always be yourself. Don't try to be anybody else. Don't let people tell you you can't do something. If you are really passionate and committed to it, dedicate that, you know, yourself to that and improving yourself and striving for your ultimate goal. And your dream is never too big. So dream as big as possible and go for it. And if you've got something to say, never be afraid to challenge or ask questions. It's important. It's part of learning and growing. It takes one person to start a movement. So if it's really important to you, be that voice. There'll definitely be at least one more other person that will join your movement.
Thanks so much to Anita for taking the time to talk to me. We wish her well for the future in her ambitions in coaching and beyond. If you'd like to hear more about other women breaking down barriers in sport, please check out our previous episodes of The Game Changers, with guests that include rugby union legend Maggie Alfonsi, the most decorated female Paralympian for GB of all time, Sarah Storey, Olympic heptathlon champion Denise Lewis, and GB and England hockey captain and Olympic gold medalist Kate Richardson-Walsh. Thanks so much to Barclays for their support for this series of The Game Changers. They're making a big difference in helping us to share the stories of these incredible women. It's always lovely to hear that people are enjoying the podcast. Do let us know what you think by finding us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram at The Game Changers or at Sue Anstis. Head over to fearlesswomen.co.uk for more information about the 66 incredible game changers featured in this and previous series. You can also listen to them all from the website, or you'll find us on all the usual podcast platforms. Thanks to Sam Walker, executive producer of the podcast, and to Rory Askrey, who does a great job on sound production. Next week, I'm so excited to be talking to Fleur Robinson, recently appointed chief executive at Wrexham, the football club now owned by Hollywood stars Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney. This follows Fleur's huge success as commercial director at Burton Albion. Fleur has a real passion for putting football at the heart of the community and making a positive difference to people's lives. I can't wait to talk to her.
Being in that environment, you tend to act in certain ways, really. And I think I've always sort of leaned towards, you know, male friends, male coaches or mentors. And, you know, and I think it's only probably in the last 3 years that I've really started to connect with females. And it's a shame, really, because, I should have recognised that a long time ago. There's a lot of support out there. And again, I suppose, you know, when I started, there wasn't any females in my role. Or, you know, it was hard to sort of reach out and find those people to speak to. But certainly now I've got a great network of female leaders and, you know, friends that are really supportive.
The Game Changers. Fearless women in sport.